Trade Bites. Trade Bites. The podcast about trade policy. Hello and welcome to another episode of Trade Bites, the podcast series by the Center for Inclusive Trade Policy and hosted by me, Chris Horseman, Deputy Editor of the Trade Policy News Service, Borderlex. And in this episode, we're focusing on the thing that everybody cares about, whether they're trade geeks or not, namely our food and where it comes from and goes to. The UK has a long history as an agricultural trading nation. For most of our existence, we've been a net importer of food, creating a virtue of free trade economics out of the necessity of needing to feed ourselves. But calibrating a well-balanced trade policy for agriculture and food is a notoriously difficult thing to do. When we were part of the EU, Brussels was frequently criticised for being excessively protectionist, criticism which was often justified. But now that the UK is a free agent in trade policy terms, just how much has actually changed? Have we put our money where our mouth was, as it were, and adopted a liberal agri-food trade policy? What impact are the bureaucratic barriers to trade with the EU, which Brexit created, actually having on UK food importers and exporters? What difference will the UK's new trade agreements with partners around the world actually make to the economics of producing and selling food here in the UK? And is it at all feasible that we'll get through an entire podcast about agri-food trade without once mentioning chlorinated chicken? I wouldn't bet on it. Well, these are all complex questions, but the good news is that we have some excellent guests with us today to help us inwardly digest these spicy issues at stake. I'm joined by Fiona Smith, Professor in International Economic Law at the University of Leeds. It's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Ludovine Petitin, Reader in Law at Cardiff University and a member of the Centre for Inclusive Trade Policy. And it's great to have with us Nick von Westenholtz, Director of Strategy at the England and Wales National Farmers Union. Thanks to all of you for being with us today. Fiona, if I can start with you, just sort of set the scene. How important is international trade to the UK agri-food sector? What role do imports and exports play in our food economy?
Well, international trade in food is really critical for the UK, Chris. So we know that on the export side, our farmers and food industry, it benefits from export markets across the world, particularly the EU and the US. And in 2022, the latest statistics show that where they generated £24.9 billion of revenue from that. So really important income. But as you say, the UK is not self-sufficient in food. So we're really reliant on imports. And we actually import 54% of our vegetables and over 84% of our fresh fruit. So it's important that we can always get access to that. Now, when we are thinking about agriculture, it's really easy just to focus on the physical products that are going backwards and forwards. But trade in agriculture is so much more important than that. And we need to think as well about inputs like the feed that we import to feed the animals. So 6 million tons of feed comes in every year for animal feed. And then there's the fertilizer as well that we use on our crops. And the UK, again, is not self-sufficient in fertiliser, and 60% of the nitrogen that we need is imported. And it's imported from complicated places like Ukraine and Russia. So these are really volatile places. We need to be mindful of where things come from. And just a couple of final points that people may not be thinking about in relation to trade and agriculture is labour. We're reliant on seasonal workers to pick our fruits. And over 58,000 seasonal workers come from countries like Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan every year just to pick that produce. And what about the technology that we use on the farm? These days, the combine harvesters and the tractors, they're all linked to satellites. So farming is much more of a precision process than it ever was. And those smart tractors and smart harvesters rely on technology that is traded. We may not even think about it in those terms, but internet connections, satellite feeds, all of this digital trade is also part of the agriculture trade picture.
It's a multifaceted picture. Thank you for that introduction. Nick, in any trade negotiation, agriculture always seems to end up getting special treatment as a sensitive product. Why do we treat agricultural products differently from any other products? Why should we do that?
Well, Fiona has just outlined all of the reasons why trade in agricultural goods and related goods, is, including, of course, labour, is so important. I don't think agriculture is totally different than any other trade in goods, but it does, you're right, it does end up being often the most difficult bit of any trade negotiation. And of course, if you look around the world where tariffs continue to exist on goods, it tends to be agricultural products. And that suggests that countries are sensitive about those, as you put them, sensitive products. And I think there's a couple of reasons there. I think, firstly, because countries are very concerned about their food security. So, as again Fiona outlined, there are advantages from trade for food security. Imports for many countries are critical in ensuring food security. But also, countries are very concerned and careful not to undermine their own capacity for producing food on their own shores, as it were. And so they naturally want to tread very carefully, I think, when it comes to doing something that might damage their own productive capacity. So therefore, it is a tricky area. I think the other reason is often agricultural industries, sectors, are based in less well-off parts of the country. They're often fairly low-income parts of an economy. And that applies for developed countries as much as developing countries. And therefore, again, when you have the potential for liberalizing trade to undermine domestic industries, that carries with it a heightened risk, I would suggest. So for that reason, I think, understandably, countries tread very carefully when it comes to liberalizing trade in agriculture.
Ludovine, we can't talk for long about agriculture policy or trade policy without mentioning Brexit. What impact has leaving the EU sort of had on our patterns of agri-food trade?
Well, actually, looking at the statistics, very little has changed. And as Fiona mentioned, the EU remains the largest UK trading partner for both imports and exports. So mostly we get most of our things from the EU, with quite a bit of export to the US. But otherwise, it hasn't changed very much, because it takes a while actually for the agri-food supply chain to change and adapt. So it's not something that's done overnight. It's the same with all the new trade agreements that the UK has signed. Those will take a while to actually change our agri-food supply chain. But of course, something to bear in mind here is how much more costly it is to trade with the EU, both exports and imports. And obviously, the UK is now moving to the next phase of new checks at its borders. And obviously, that means new costs in terms of paperwork, in terms of physical checks for live animals, animals products, plants and plant products, which obviously will have an impact on what we can get as in terms of food products. But of course, the EU is the main trading partner, but we have increased both imports and exports to the rest of the world. And in particular, at the moment, we're looking at the Gulf region in terms of having future trade deals. And perhaps something I wanted also to highlight is, we often think about agri-food trade as external, but something that has been very positive with Brexit is actually that now we actually have some data when it comes to where our food goes within the UK, which before we didn't know. So the data coming from the Office for the Internal Market is actually really useful to know where the devolved nations in particular send their agri-food products to. England doesn't provide that data yet.
Okay, let's stay with the UK relationship with the EU just for a moment. We have the Trade and Cooperation Agreement with the EU. This features 100% tariff-free trade for all products, including agri-food products. It's the only EU FTA that has this feature. So did Britain get a good deal with its post-Brexit agri-food trade settlements with the EU?
It probably depends on your view of whether Brexit was a good idea or not, because clearly it is a more liberalised deal than anybody else in the world has with indeed any other trading partner other than those members of the EU with each other. And that was a point often made by other countries in their negotiations with the UK, like Australia and New Zealand, that given the EU and the UK had such a liberalised deal, then they should have something similar. But of course, it represented a massive increase in friction and in trade barriers from what previously existed. So the lack of tariffs is clearly a helpful thing. And in light of the potential of a no-deal Brexit, where there was the possibility of tariffs being imposed on our exports to the EU, and Ludovine has explained how important that market is, that would have been incredibly problematic. But of course, outside of those zero tariff, zero quota parts of the deal, there are now considerable other barriers to trade. And we've seen a lot of those causing problems for food exporters, particularly smaller businesses, over the last few years. And now those similar controls, checks, fees, etc., will be brought in on imports from the EU. So it is a better deal comparing it with others, but it is certainly not in terms of freedom of trade than what the UK enjoyed previously.
I think one of the things we have to remember as well is that the EU-UK deal is a trade deal. And so to benefit from that trade deal, the products have to originate in the EU and the UK. And this is complicated rules of origin. And although with agricultural products, most of the time we can think of them being grown in the UK and exported to the EU, so that's not a problem. But things like tinned peaches, where the fruit is tropical fruit and is maybe canned in the UK, that may not benefit from this tariff-free deal. So there's lots of difficulty in the detail of the EU-UK trade deal that means that not all aspects of EU agricultural trade benefit from it.
As well as the rules of origin, I will say also that the TCA builds also very minimally on two World Trade Organization agreements. So the technical barriers to trade and the sanitary and phytosanitary agreement, which means then that, you know, we're slightly above what exists on the international level. And therefore, this means that as barriers to trade were re-erected between the UK and the EU, it's directly impacting agri-food products. So the fact that we don't have SPS equivalents between the UK and the EU means, as I mentioned earlier, that those physical checks are coming in, and this is incredibly difficult, in particular for agri-food products.
You mentioned SPS equivalent there, sanitary and phytosanitary rules. This is something which the UK government has not been prepared to go too far down that road until now. We are going to have an election at some point this year. It looks probable that there will be a change of government. And there has been speculation about how far perhaps a new government might move in terms of re-establishing these regulatory alignments with the European Union. In your view, what do you think a future UK government should focus on as delivering potentially the biggest potential benefits to the UK agri-food sector, given the political constraints that it will, of course, face? Ludovine.
I would say we need SPS equivalents. We need a veterinary agreement between the EU and the UK, and I would even say the EFTA zone, which would be really beneficial to UK agri-food trade. To give you just one example in terms of the fact that we have a ban on the seeds of potatoes for GB products, so Northern Ireland, that's not the case. But that in 2019 was worth £12 million. So this is something quite substantial we are talking about here, and that's just talking about seed potatoes. So having this equivalence would also be very beneficial, as I mentioned. And now to go back to the rules of origin, and I'm going to push perhaps far too much down the line here, but what we need is a customs union to join back the customs union with the EU, which would make trading so much easier and would make rules of origins go away, which means it would be much easier to trade.
It's almost as though Brexit wasn't a good idea. Fiona, what's your view?
I guess the depends on how far along the customs union line we want to go, whether the new UK government has any appetite for that. But there's a couple of models that we might want to look at. And one is the EU has an agreement with New Zealand where they have these equivalence rules, as Ludovine's already outlined. But then there's the more drastic approach, which is the EU-Switzerland model, where the Swiss have agreed to follow the EU rules in relation to the health and welfare of the animals and the plant standards and follow what's called dynamic alignment between the two systems. So this would allow exports of animal and plant products to the EU and back from the EU to the UK. It would make it frictionless. So it would be a partial customs union, really, just in relation to veterinary agreements. So this would be a way forward, I think.
A lot of this is a political question, probably, rather than an economic one. I think what Ludivine and Fiona have suggested there sort of makes a lot of sense economically, but whether we're able to go there politically, I think, is a whole different question. And I would suggest we're certainly nowhere near probably rejoining the customs union or a customs union at the moment, not least because it would undermine the FTAs that the UK has recently already done. The other point is, and I'd agree that some kind of veterinary or SPS agreement would be very sensible just to reduce checks and reduce friction. There are some outstanding issues that need to be resolved even in doing that. I mean, not least, for example, the UK, one of the few areas where the UK has begun to diverge or looked to diverge from a regulatory perspective is around gene editing and breeding plant varieties, for instance, within that. And that might be therefore create some difficulty in negotiating equivalence. It doesn't have to, I don't think, but it just presents some tension really in finding that balance between equivalence but having some kind of regulatory autonomy. So these are not simple questions, but certainly I think trying to find some kind of agreement around equivalence is going to be a crucial priority for the next government.
Now, Nick, you mentioned the UK's FTAs with Australia and New Zealand back then. These agreements have not been universally popular, certainly not among the farming sector. So these were agreements where we basically said to Australia and New Zealand, yep, we will get rid of all tariffs over a period of up to 15 years, a lot quicker in most cases. Does Britain actually know, as a society, do we know what we want when it comes to agri-food trade? Do we want to be a liberal trading country that just looks for cheap food wherever it can find it? Or have we not been honest, perhaps, about the trade-offs that that involves? I wonder what we think about that.
I think you got it absolutely right there. I think there was a lack of honesty, a lack of frankness about what these trade deals would involve. I mean, I think one of the problems was the first two trade deals, new trade deals the UK government decided to do were with countries who are hugely efficient agricultural producers, massive net exporters, smallish populations. And so our agricultural sector was always going to be in a defensive position negotiating with those two countries. I'd have much happier to have picked more balanced partners to have done negotiations with straight up. And the government's own impact assessment showed that agriculture and semi-processed foods would experience a negative impact from both the Australia and UK deals. Despite that being in the government's own impact assessment, farmers and the public at large were consistently told that farming would be at the heart and would be a priority in those negotiations. And this would be nothing but upside for farming. I mean, you know, you don't need to be an economist to have realized that that is very unlikely to be the case if you're going to do trade deals with those sorts of countries for the reasons I set out. Now, there's a perfectly valid argument to be made around that if you prize liberalization and cheaper imports above all else, but you have to then accept what the potential impacts on your domestic farming sector will be. And I don't think that ever really happened. So there is no doubt, as I said, looking at the government's own impact assessment, that the potential, and it does remain potential, but the potential for significant negative impacts on UK farming is there in these trade deals. So they are concerning. We'll see what happens. But we would have much rather have done negotiations, trade deals with countries who may have been interested in importing the great food that we produce.
I think one of the problems is the government doesn't have a trade strategy. So it has a food strategy, but it doesn't have a trade strategy. And often when it talks about trade, it's very much thinking about exports. So where can UK export agri-food to? And I think that causes real problems because, as Nick said, trade strategy is definitely in the export piece, but it's also about imports and the kind of society we want to be. Do we want to import chlorine washed chicken? How do we feel about gene editing? These are big questions that we need to think about.
I would like to say, so you talked about Britain as a society, and I think there are different nations across the UK, and I think with different interests, with different attachments to farming. And of course, the fact that there are no formal mechanisms for the devolved nations to feed into the development of trade policy, trade strategy, although we don't have one, as Fiona mentioned. But the fact that there is no formal involvement, so no formal mechanisms, there are informal mechanisms, is also reflecting in the agreements that we have, because we don't see the kind of variety in terms of heritage, cultural approach, languages, thinking about the Welsh language in particular, that is core to the devolved nations, that maybe is not the same in England. And this is also to bear in mind that there are four nations across the UK, and that not all of those four nations are formally represented in the trade deals that we sign.
And that question of the tricky relationship between the central UK state and the devolved governments was one of the subjects of a podcast we did on a trade scrutiny, which is also available in the Trade Bites series for anyone who is interested. Now, Fiona, you mentioned the C word, the double C word, chlorinated chicken. So anyone who took my bet at the start of this podcast has now lost their money. We were always going to talk about it. Would it really be such a problem, in your view, if we allowed imports of such goods? I mean, people make the case that thousands of British people go to America every year. They eat chicken. Nobody seems to be any the worse for it. So why are they such a trade irritant between the UK and the US in particular?
The main problem, Chris, is in terms of we've inherited a lot of our food safety regulation from the EU, and these washes, chlorine washes, hormone-treated beef, these kind of preparations for food are not permitted under EU rules. And I think it's more a question of thinking about the kind of approach you want to have to these kind of washes going forward. I think that's a big question. It raises issues that Ludovine's already mentioned. In terms of regulation in the UK, one of the problems you've got to think about is often trade regulation focuses very much on the products themselves. So how is beef treated? How is sheep meat treated? But they don't focus on the preparation of the products, the way things are grown, the way things are prepared. And that can cause real friction within the WTO, the World Trade Organization rules, and can actually cause countries that do allow these preparations to bring cases before the WTO and argue that the UK is actually in violation. So there's real issues there. And I think it's going to be a question of how the UK wants to deal with these issues going forward.
I would add that looking at what the UK is very good at exporting, we're talking often about premium products. So high animal welfare, no hormones, no GM, etc. So as Fiona mentioned, we're talking about high production, high product standards that are more socially, more environmentally, and also more animal welfare responsible. And I think this is important to bear that in mind. So if we start to deregulate, what sort of impact will this have on our exports, where we say, yes, we want those higher level of protection when it comes to the environment, animal welfare. And this could open the door to something I think Britain as a society does not necessarily want. And now also thinking another perhaps aspect, but that's going back a little bit, the fact that playing with animals is also something that brings back the mad cow disease and for the older generation. And that's also important to bear that in mind, because it's still in the UK public's what they think. So that's also perhaps something to bear in mind.
From the farmer perspective, there are numerous standards, production standards that we have to adhere to, mostly related around environmental impact and animal welfare, which are different from food standards and safety standards. And I think it's totally understandable that from a farmer perspective, they'd feel very unhappy if imports that aren't required to meet those standards are nevertheless coming onto the UK market. Often those standards will impose cost on UK farmers, so that's a competitive issue as well, and they're having to compete against it. So whatever the standards we have, it does seem to me reasonable and equitable that imports should meet those same standards. Now, for the reasons that I think Fiona touched on, actually this becomes very complicated because of the distinction in international trade law between production standards and product standards. And actually, I think that those issues, WTO rules, obligations, etc., need to sort of move forward into the 21st century, quite frankly, where product standards are very well controlled for. Production standards are largely, if not completely, ignored. But, you know, the chlorinated chicken one is a great example because actually, formally speaking, it's a product standard. It's the safety of the end product that is disputed under that issue. But actually, for farmers in the UK, for them, it'll be a production standard because they will be following a very different approach to production in order to make sure that the animal is well looked after and safe to consume at the end of the chain. Very different process to those in, for example, North America.
So there are basic ground rules for international trade, which are predominantly set by the World Trade Organization, of which the UK is now an autonomous member since Brexit. From your perspective, what role do you see the UK playing in sort of helping to upgrade and modernize these rules? Does the UK have the kind of clout that it would like to have to make an impact with international negotiations?
It's clear since the UK left the EU that it's no longer able to drive the agenda through sheer market size. That's clear. But what we are seeing is the UK brokering deals between medium size and large nations. So that is really positive. And I think you can see that in some of the talks around reform of the agriculture rules in terms of it talking about that it's important to keep markets open and not return to heavily protecting markets. So really believing in free trade, but not at the expense of growing crops that damage the environment or raising animals to poor welfare standards. So they're trying to walk a middle ground, and there's been public statements by our representative in the WTO to this effect, which I think is really positive. And something that is a general issue is also UK leading on wider issues like women's economic empowerment, which is important in agriculture. I mean, probably less so in the UK, but globally, these are really important issues. So I think the UK is doing a great job in the WTO.
Yeah, I was going to say something similar to Fiona. I think there is the scope, and the UK has sort of looked as if it has some interest in this agenda, but maybe has been a little bit tentative of moving, as I mentioned previously, moving the WTO and the broader international trading environment to a more kind of progressive stage where actually issues like production standards, like animal welfare, of course, climate change are integrated much more closely into trade rules so that trade is not simply based on, which I'm afraid I think it has been, you know, who can secure the cheapest good produced at the lowest cost, financially speaking, but actually at the lowest cost environmentally speaking, and also taking into other important considerations as Fiona just mentioned. So there is definitely a role, and you would hope that post-Brexit, that the narrative from the UK government around global Britain would include that, a willingness to really pioneer and drive a new approach and changes to how we do things in the international trading community. And probably the last point to make is that the WTO is at the moment slightly hobbling forward. It's not an easy place at the best of times to achieve progress. And at the moment, I think it's struggling really to move things forward. So whether some of this agenda needs to be moved forward outside of the WTO or only with certain members of the WTO, I think that's an important question and maybe the sensible way forward.
I completely agree with what Nick and Fiona have said. And what I wanted to add is that, yes, it's nice to push for reforms, you know, various reforms within the WTO, but this should be also reflected within the UK and also the trade deals that it signs. Because as Nick mentioned, we clearly see that there are discrepancies. You can push for certain things at the WTO, but those, if they are not reflected in the trade deals that you sign, then this shows big discrepancies, and it's very difficult then for future trading partners to think of what does the UK want, which goes back to the previous questions. And another aspect also to mention is that we want further reform within the WTO, but we also need to look at reform within. And as I said, and I'm going to repeat that, we need to look at what other countries that are decentralized, are devolved, are doing to feed into our trade policies, how they practice it. And Canada is really a cautionary tale that the UK should clearly look at. The UK needs joint ownership from the devolved in order to have those trade deals.
So as we start to move towards wrapping up our podcast, I'd just like to ask one final question to each of you. And it's about the challenges that UK producers in particular are facing. This is a rather simplistic way of putting it, but will international trade come to the rescue of the UK agri-food sector or finish it off for good? In other words, is free trade a positive, something which will liberate the UK productive sector, or is it more of a threat? Nick, as a representative of the UK agricultural sector, let me come to you first on that.
Well, great question. And obviously, none of us have a crystal ball. First thing saying is the UK government has changed tack a little bit in the last couple of years from where it was previously. Where we saw the approach it took with the Australian-New Zealand deals was what you might call an ultra-liberalising approach, which I think does pose a significant threat to UK agriculture. More recently, with the CPTPP deal that we've acceded to, and also actually the government's decision to walk away from negotiations with Canada, I think demonstrate that it's more willing to try and find a middle ground. That's still to try and liberalise trade and to try and increase trade in agricultural goods, but not in a way that throws away any ability to safeguard agriculture if needed, if it's struggling under the impact of liberalisation. But the final point I'd make, I think, is that, and I think it's something which is totally lacking from the understanding of many of our political masters in recent years when they've pursued their trade policy, is there are trade-offs in trade policy and liberalizing trade. There are winners and losers. The idea that everybody is a winner may work in theory. And the idea is that you liberalize trade and even those who lose in the short term ultimately gain from the benefits, and even to the extent that they can retrain or benefit from those other areas of our economy which have specialized and have benefited from free trade. In practice, what does that actually look like? You know, what does that look like for a Welsh hill farmer? What are you asking them to do as a result of losing their business and liberalization? You know, are they to move into cities and retrain as, I don't know, call center workers or something? You know, in practice, there needs to be a lot more thought about what free trade means, not just for sectors, but for communities as well. These are really fundamental to our identity, many of these farming and rural communities. So we need to move forward very carefully. As I say, I think there's been evidence that the government is much more alive to that in the last year or two than they maybe have been previously. But that is really what is needed, a balance between getting the benefits from free trade, liberalizing somewhat, but not in a way that really damages and undermines for good some of our domestic producers.
Ludovine, would you agree with Nick's assessment there?
Yes, I agree. It's important to look at the temporality of the trade deals that we're signing. Some of them will give unfettered access in 10, 15 years. So it's not something that is going to happen tomorrow. So yes, it gives us time to prepare, but also it means that in 10 to 15 years' time, depending on which trade deal we're looking at, those countries like Australia, New Zealand, or Mexico will come in and will create a lot of competition and potentially undercutting, undermining UK producers. And this is really important to bear in mind. What I would also say as a second point, perhaps, is that to just say that we need policy coherence or policy coordination, whichever way you want to say it, where, you know, we need coordination, coherence between trade, agriculture, environment, public health, social aspects. We need those policies to work together. And at the moment, they don't. They're all siloed, they're all compartmentalized, and it just doesn't work. What we need really is a trade policy that supports agri-food, that supports the environment. And this is something that we need to work towards. And I would say finally, similarly, and again, including the interests of the devolved nations within those discussions.
Fiona, a final word from you.
What's very important is that when the UK trades, it's thinking in terms of inputting into complex supply chains. So in terms of where the food's going, will those markets be stable? Are they going to be available? Are those markets going to source goods from elsewhere? We're relying on exports into the EU, but as it becomes more expensive to export from the UK into the EU, maybe more complicated, perhaps those domestic buyers in the EU will source goods from elsewhere. So what will that mean for the UK farmers and food industry? And more importantly, the world is becoming a lot more volatile. The UK is reliant on imports of food and inputs for its food sector. It's becoming a lot more volatile. We have climate change. So places we've sourced food from, maybe in Saharan Africa, those markets may not be available for us to source food from anymore. We're seeing droughts in some of those countries. We're also seeing political volatility, problems getting food through the Red Sea because of the Israel-Palestine conflict. We're seeing difficulties with the Russia-Ukraine. I've talked about fertilizer already. So this economic security piece is really an important part of what the UK should be looking at in its trade strategy. And we're not seeing enough about how that economic security links with trade and agriculture, links with devolved policies, the devolved nations' expectations in trade, and how that all fits together. And so we do need a coherent trade strategy going forward.
It is a huge topic, but I think we've covered a lot of the issues involved here. For which many thanks to my excellent guests today. Thank you to Professor Fiona Smith, to Dr. Ludovine Petitin, and to Nick von Westenholtz for joining me today. And to you, the listener, many thanks for your company today. So do join us again soon when we return for another episode of Trade Bites. Trade Bites is brought to you by the Centre for Inclusive Trade Policy, supported by the Economic and Social Research Council.